Welcome to the 40th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
40 not out, and unlike the unfortunate Black Caps, we're hoping to make it past 45.
They say life starts at 40, and we've got all kinds of excitement coming up in today's episode. We're going to be looking at the cricket that's been happening over the last couple of weeks. We're also going to be taking inspiration from the snow that's currently falling outside and looking at the relationship between cricket and bad weather. We're going to be talking about Dennis Compton's end of an innings, and we're going to be asking whether the men's and women's games should mix, as well as having a chat with the top cricket photographer, Philip Brown. What's caught your eye over the last couple of weeks?
Well, my highlight's actually one that's off the cricketing field, and it's the announcement of the ECB's Touts Out campaign. Basically, the ECB have said they've launched this new high-profile, big-money campaign to try and go after ticket touting, particularly in its online form, particularly in the form of Viagogo. And what they've said is that selling tickets at more than their cost price is against the terms and conditions. If you use that, and if you do that, you risk not being admitted. Your ticket may not be valid, but may not be valid if you buy it at that price. And Viagogo probably came out and said, oh, we've got great partnerships with several other big sporting bodies. We offer an important service, a valuable service. And my feeling is all a service like Viagogo does is put a smart veneer on what is an unpleasant activity. It's taking tickets that are already expensive and making a profit out of them. I mean, for what? You know, you've not delivered any service. Touting is unpleasant. Fans don't benefit from it in any way. And I'm glad to see that the ECB, compared to a lot of international bodies, are making a stand on it. I think it's exciting.
The problem is, I think, that the Lords, for instance, doesn't accept... If you buy a ticket and can't go to a game, Lords won't give you your money back and sort of buy that ticket back off you, and you're forced to, and it explicitly condones your selling that ticket on to other people. And whilst absolutely there's a world of difference between, you know, you and I, honest people that we are, selling on a ticket at face value to someone else, that as soon as you have an encouragement for that kind of independent sort of marketplace, which isn't controlled at all by the people who are selling the tickets in the first place, then actually it's quite difficult, it would seem to me, to then go out and say to Viagogo, you can't do
it. It's a very valid point, because I think you have to offer that service for returns. And when a series is as popular, for example, as the Ashes, you can't think, well, it's almost an obvious thing to do.
No.
But I just feel like it's one of these rare things where I actually have total support for the ECB. I think it's a really unpleasant practice, and I dislike it being given a kind of legitimate veneer by big companies like Viagogo. It's not a service. You're literally making money out of doing and offering nothing, and the only people who are getting screwed over are the fans. Back to more... Wow, that was quite an early episode rant. I'm not really holding back today. Back to the cricket field. You've been focused on events in Australia, which kind of followed a pretty miserable test series.
Yeah, it's the test series sort of got me through Christmas, or didn't really get me through Christmas, because it was pretty depressing. I mean, we were discussing a few minutes ago that actually the... There's been a pretty depressing last month in Test cricket,
particularly horribly one-sided.
Particularly with the New Zealand South Africa series as well. But it's been slightly heartening with the. I mean, maybe I'm scraping the barrel and looking for hope, but it's been slightly heartening the fact that the Sri Lankans have sort of perked up slightly in the one days, and we very often see after Test series that the one day match is going completely the opposite direction, and perhaps this is slightly that the Australians are taking their foot off the gas a bit. But
seeing Australia knocked over for 70-odd is always fun.
It's always touchable, exactly. But I think it's really important for Sri Lanka that Sangakkara isn't playing in this series, Jayawardene is not going to be around forever. And actually, they've shown a bit of fight in these one days, which they could easily have rolled over and just submitted.
I think fight's the key thing, isn't it? Because they didn't appear to show any fight. I mean, a bit of fight in the first test, but beyond that, they've been really miserable.
It's been quite satisfying seeing Tiramana's century as well, which is in the second one day, which after a pretty poor test series, Sri Lanka needs some batsmen who are actually going to sort of
and they're one of those
lead
teams,
the new generation.
They're easy to like, aren't they, Sri Lanka? Sort of play cricket in a sort of colourful, exciting way, consistently defy the odds, you know, with obviously you look at their population and their size. Well, my low point of the last couple of weeks was also Australia-based, and it was the cricket incident that perhaps has got more attention than any other for a while, actually. It's sort of a lot of non-cricket fans have been looking at it as well. It was the Shane Warne and Marlon Samuels scrap in the Big Bash. And I watched this initially, like many other people did. It was the first top most viewed event on the BBC Sport website for quite a while. And my initial reaction was, oh, it's just quite funny, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's Warren's pathetic kind of little flick of the ball at Samuels. Samuels is rather bizarre hurling the bat. And, I, like most people, I had a bit of a laugh. And then on further reflection, I kind of thought, actually, it was really unpleasant. And there was something in the hostility between the two, particularly actually from Warren. I'm not saying, I don't know how you separate blame and an incident like that, but particularly his aggression. Mm-hmm. And it made me think, well, you know, aggression has a place in cricket.
Although throwing a bat is pretty aggressive. I mean, it was a fairly casual toss, but still, it was throwing a bat is...
I think casual toss is the right phrase. It wasn't really... When I heard it, I thought, you know, did he
if he was aiming for him, he was doing a pretty bad job.
He kind of tossed it in the air, kind of almost... I like the fact they then thought, oh, we'll run him out, which they didn't. But you think, cricket... Aggression in cricket's fine, I think. A bit of sledging's fine. But a bowling aggressive, but you realise that there was something really unpleasant about this open hostility between players in each other's faces. And I'm a football fan, I see it on a football pitch all the time, and I suddenly realised it's one of the things I treasure about cricket, that we don't get this nonsense. And I thought, I was glad to hear that the punishments came through, and if anything, I think they could have been harsher. And shame on Shane Warne as well, for a player who, a lot of time for, you think, surely he got to an age now, you know, he's got Liz Hurley, he's got the kids, like... Relax.
You should calm down. Well, one person who would certainly have looked on with great displeasure at that incident was Christopher Martin Jenkins, who sadly died a couple of weeks ago. I think it's fair to say that both of our generation of cricket lovers, cricket listeners, cricket watchers, cricket readers have had our experience of cricket hugely shaped by him. I mean, it's such a cliche, but I can certainly remember, you know, as a 12-year-old lying on my bed listening to Test Match Special, and when CMJ was commentating, you know, all was right with the world. And actually, one of the really interesting things has been that the kind of corpus of writing that's grown up over the last 2 weeks in response to his death has been one. I mean, some of the pieces have been astoundingly beautiful, and it's kind of a mark of the respect and the inspiration that he gave to a lot of people.
I think there's a sense amongst a lot of the obituaries that he's been written that he might genuinely be the last of his kind in a way. He is a real gentleman, and he also was a real professional broadcaster. He wasn't one of these ex-players who's kind of made the transition. Broadcasting for him was a life, it was a passion, and it was a vocation.
And there was always a sense when he... You know, the combination, say, of him and Geoffrey Boycott, there's always, sometimes with Jonathan Agnew, it sort of ends up with sort of pulling each other's leg and that kind of, you know, joking about how many pies Mike Gatting's eaten, etc., etc. But with CMJ, there was always that enormous respect that everyone obviously had for him and his knowledge of the game that I think means that he's one of the, you know, central people in defining how we will all remember the game.
From the archives, and this episode, as England grinds to a halt under the snow, Toby is going to reflect on those precious few moments when cricket and snow have mixed.
I was actually surprised when I started thinking about this to find out that cricket and snow go back quite a long way, actually, and have quite a frequent association. And you might think that they're probably...
Well, I suppose, you know, both cricket and snow have been around for a while.
They have been around, and the fact that they've coincided is not unlikely. And mostly it's because people have kind of tried to manufacture cricket matches in snow for the sake of, I suppose, proving a point, because they seem such polar opposites. If that's not the kind of wrong pun to use when it comes to snow. In 2007, Graham Napier and Mark Waugh, that's the Nottinghamshire batsman, not the Australian, played a six-a-side, eight-over game on the Everest Base Camp to raise money for charity.
That's extraordinary, because you so often get these charity-raising exploits, you know, involving... you know, running a long distance, kind of, you're sailing a long distance. It's quite an interesting one, because you're sort of taking cricket to a place where... It's quite an interesting one. It's not so much the physical challenge as just playing a sport somewhere where it really, really shouldn't
be. Well, and actually, it was combined with the physical challenge, because they had to walk to base camp, and there's quite an interesting... Graham Napier wrote quite an interesting piece, I think it's a newspaper interview, actually, where he talks about the fact that they get there and their feet are just completely covered in... blisters in their hands, they've got massive chilblains all over them, and so it's not obviously not an ideal situation to be playing cricket in. Here on Reverse Web Radio, we've reviewed Harry Thompson's When Pingu Stop Play, which is the story of a madcap global tour, which starts off with a game in honour of Captain Scott in Antarctica, and the pitch, as the book's title suggests, is invaded by penguins. But actually, the South Pole has seen quite a lot of the Red Bull. Early last year, in 2012, the centenary of the same Captain Scott's fatal expedition was marked by, you know, you could go out there and plant a flag or something like that, but no, it was marked by a game of cricket. And rather wonderfully, the leader of the expedition explained, "I thought it was quintessentially British, and I wanted to do something that does not happen down here very often."
It does somehow seem quite appropriate for Captain Scott, because Captain Scott has come across as the, you know, down the ages as sort of the defiant English hero who doesn't quite get things right, and somehow cricket fits with that quite nicely.
And I think that it seems to actually be an almost exclusively English thing. The Australians don't seem to have the same desire to go off and play cricket in the Arctic.
I guess it's because it's less about it's got very little to do with playing good cricket, does it?
It's more about making a statement.
Right. And
exactly. There was an interesting story about a group of British diplomats in Beijing who went and found a frozen lake to play a game of cricket on, presumably because they were, you know, bored one afternoon and couldn't see through the smog. David Gower participated in a charity match on a frozen lake in Samaritz in Switzerland in the early 90s. And most amusingly, I think it was one of these things that was very much put on for show, you know, put on for the cameras. No one was actually really playing properly. You know, people weren't taking diving catches in the outfield. They finished the game. Gower went off and went back to where his car was, and there was a massive hole in the ice, and his car, unfortunately, had disappeared.
I do feel that, I mean, that would be, if someone invited me to play cricket on the ice, that would be my first cowardly question.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you know, am I okay on this?
It's happened in the other direction. There was some, there was a group of climate change researchers, American and English, who were in submarines up in the Arctic, and they were under the ice in submarines for quite a long time, a few weeks, I think, and they, when they emerged, they decided to celebrate by playing a game of cricket. And I'm not sure whether this bit's actually true or not, but apparently the US State Defense Department, because the whole thing was being done as some, you know, had a bit of secrecy around it, refused to tell anyone what the result of the cricket game was, and they insisted that none of the people who were there, you know, in the same vein as they weren't allowed to say what any of their scientific findings were, they weren't allowed. But apparently the British won by two wickets. But I think actually the very best game of cricket in snow ever happened back in 1951, when Howard Macmillan, who was then the head of the Board of Trade, took part in a slightly impromptu game during a big conference. And he puts it rather well in his own words. "My second over was interrupted by a gentleman from the NKVD, which is the Soviet Secret Police, who was appointed to follow us around and see that we came to no harm. He stood in the middle of the pitch and remonstrated with us in a very long Russian speech. He was supported by two men who came up on horseback with rifles. I persuaded him, after some negotiation, to take up his position at square leg out of the way of even my bowling." I think it's this marvellous image of these British diplomats who are in, presumably, you know, 1951 in Moscow. It's pretty serious negotiation. And they just decide to wander off and hold them in a snowy clearing in a forest, just decide to hold a game of cricket.
But
just to sort of,
I think it's wonderful because it shows both a kind of a very British unwillingness to take anything too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, the British, like, we're in the middle of this conference, let's go and play cricket. But also at the same time, it does show a wonderful fanaticism for the game. It's like, we're in Russia, we've got nothing better to do, let's play cricket. It's rather curious.
But actually, professionals have been known to mix cricket and snow, even if not willingly. At times, there's an infamous county game in June 1975, the 1st of June 1975, and that was one of the hottest summers on record. And out of some bizarre meteorological, I can't even pronounce meteorological, so I'm not even going to attempt to explain what the phenomenon was. But the first day was played in bright sunshine, everyone got sunburned. Second day, it started raining just as the players and the officials arrived. And then heavy snow started falling in about half an hour, complete whiteout. Dickie Bird, who was umpiring, went out and inspected the pitch, although when it's snowing, I don't really know why a pitch inspection is particularly necessary. Went out, inspected the pitch whilst ankle deep in snow. And then even more bizarrely, the next day, so they abandoned play for the day, the next day, completely dry, blazing sunshine, all the snow was gone. Unfortunately, Derbyshire, who were playing against Lancashire, I think, in this game, realised that a snow-laden pitch isn't particularly conducive to batting, and were bowled out for 42 and then following on for 87 and lost by an innings and several hundred runs.
But that must be, as far as tracks go, I mean, there have been a lot of tracks, you know, you play on a club level that you'd moan about. Playing on a pitch that has previously been snow-coated.
Been under a foot of snow.
It must be one. But as it, when I sort of saw that you'd chosen this rather adventurous topic, it is quite extraordinary the amount of occasions they met, and you have to feel that it says a lot to an indomitable British willingness I think, to take cricket with them to odd places.
Well, exactly, and I think it's just the fact that you see, you know, you think of cricket as a beautiful summer game, green fields everywhere, and this thing of trying to reconcile two completely paired opposites and to prove that cricket is for all times and all places obviously has a certain attraction.
And it's always about competing with the weather, isn't it? I mean, whether you're competing with an overcast day at Lord's and the ball swing, or whether you're competing with a snowstorm in Buxton. I mean, cricket's always been a big game about competing with the elements.
And so to the book review. In this episode, we are going to be looking at Dennis Compton's End of an Innings. It's worth just noting that when I turned up to record this podcast, I looked at Andy and pointed out that I had a first edition and expected him to look impressed, at which point he opened up his copy and revealed that it was signed by the author himself, which
unless it's a fake, comes as something of quite a shock, given that this was a £2.50 purchase on Amazon.
But because you're against ticket touting and inflated prices, you're only allowed to sell it on for the 25 pence that you got it from Amazon for. Anyway, Dennis Compton was quite a character, and quite a sort of, his figure was writ large across the British sporting landscape, I think it's fair to say, in the middle of the 20th century. He was started playing international cricket just before the Second World War, and came back afterwards, and really the bulk of his career happened after the war, before he finally retired in, I think, mid-50s, and then wrote this book, End of an Innings, in 1958. He was also a pretty, well, you know more about football than I do, but from
pretty
by all accounts, a pretty,
footballer.
Pretty handy footballer.
FA Cup winner with Arsenal, yeah.
Played for Arsenal and really balanced both.
And his, possibly one of the last players to ever play, really compete successfully at the top level of both sports, really, cricket and football.
Other than my old art teacher at school, Ken Taylor.
And we will
Anyway, that's a story story for another day. We digress. So, End of an Innings by Dennis Compton. What
and
do you think of it?
It's a good book. And I say that, and it sounds like I'm slightly patronising these two, but I often find with some of the older books we look back on, you know, older books meaning kind of wartime, sort of pre-World War II, that I just find them a little bit heavy going. There's often a reluctance to be opinionated. There's often, you just get match report after match report.
Yeah, very, very detailed.
And everyone's a good chap, you know, and everyone's great. Dennis Compton's book is disarmingly honest, and he also has some axes to grind, which is quite fun. And he never does it in kind of a sort of malicious way, I don't feel. It's just, he's kind of obviously decided, if I'm going to write this book, I might as well tell you what I think.
It's very interesting that he's writing in 1958. Dennis Compton and Len Hutton were basically contemporaries. They made their debut, I think Hutton made his debut a year before Compton. Hutton went on to become England captain for 10 years. Compton's writing when Hutton is still, you know, very much alive. And a lot of the characters who he criticises, Wally Hammond he criticises. But Hutton's a very interesting one for me, because he comes out and he talks particularly about when England go down to the West Indies in the early 50s and gets absolutely hammered, basically. And his criticism of Hutton, he talks about the way that Hutton treats Truman and says that he was completely incapable of handling him and he was too arrogant to be able to actually get any help from anywhere else, and that actually he wasn't the right person at all.
There's a great quote as well when he asks Hutton for help in this game where New South Wales made 530 for 3. And he asks Hutton for help, and Hutton's replies, "You'd better send for more bowlers." And Compton's response, I think, quite rightly, is to say, "Well, look, you know, he's a great captain, and this was all the help he gave me." Yeah. In terms of high-profile targets, though, you can perhaps get no more high-profile than the Don, Mr. Bradman. And Compton pulls, you know, a bit of a cliche, but Compton pulls no punches here, talking particularly about this one situation where Bradman set a field basically to force Compton to give up the strike to with a tail ender at the other end to, you know, really sort of out on the boundary to force it. And Compton quite justifiably refused to do this. And he talks about how wound up Bradman got. And it's quite an interesting insight because we always talk about Bradman as this sort of, he's seen as this cricketing untouchable, isn't he? Mm-hmm. Even in a way that actually someone like W.G. Grace isn't, actually. We all know W.G. Grace had a human side. It's quite interesting to see Bradman's slightly...
So he, Bradman says to Compton in that incident, the crowd are here to watch cricket being played. Mm. And you're just being weak, because you're just blocking everything, you're not even trying to take singles. And Compton says, well, you're not, you know, I'm here to win a game, why didn't you? And why didn't you bring in the field, and then I'll hit out? And so he brings in the field, Compton hits out, starts scoring runs, and Bradman puts everyone back on the boundary again. And it's quite, those are the things in the book that make it really worthwhile for me. There are lots of little anecdotes like that. Again, back in the, that's obviously in Australia, back in the West Indies about 5 or 6 years later, there are some wonderful descriptions. When Compton didn't cover himself in glory by having several very high-profile spats with some umpires, and obviously it's being written from Compton's point of view, but as you're saying, in a lot of cricket books of the era, the idea is to present your kind of, I mean, hagiography is taking it too far, but is to present sort of your life. This is my life and I'm going to sort of write it as I would like the world to know. Mm. Whereas Compton's very much sees the autobiography as a slightly different form, and it's, in a sense, it's slightly confessional
and he appears to actually be reflecting on the experience he's had. I think there's some wonderful anecdotes around, which I think are just, I love these stories that kind of give you kind of a flavour of the era. There's a great moment here, half-time, it's the FA Cup final, great moment of his footballing career. I felt I needed something to assist me, so I did something which I've never done before. The trainer, seeing I was tired, recommended me a glass of whiskey. It was just what I thought I needed. And you think, what an era! You know, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago, half-time of the Cup. And apparently, according to accounts, Compton was outrageous in the second half, you know.
That's obviously the trick. Lance Armstrong had it wrong when he went for...
Lance Armstrong played it, yeah.
That's not even that bag of worms. But it's interesting when you talk about him sort of being of his era, in that sense. At the end of the book, for me, the most interesting chapter of the book is the very final chapter, where he's kind of got his cricket out of the way and done with, and he talks for the first time very explicitly about the kind of persona that he has as a media figure. I mean, he was one of the first people to really exploit his status as a sportsman to get money through, I mean, most famously through promoting Brill Cream. And at the beginning,
Kevin Peterson is now a Brill Cream.
Is he?
There's a long lineage.
And at the beginning of the last chapter, he basically is talking about the way that the profession, he's looking back at his career, and he says the division between amateurs and professionals has now broken down. And very surprisingly, he said, because I would expect that he was all for, you know, essentially everyone being in it for what they could get out of it. And he says that actually it's not a good thing at all, because it's sort of broken down what is the traditional structure in the game. And actually then, in order to cover his back, he goes, but amateurs can't afford to, you know, just play off nothing. So some of us might have to, you know, employ people to look after our media interests. So by the way, I've just employed someone to look after our media interests.
So he effectively, you know, wants his cake and, you know, eats it. But I think... in that sense, you know, very much a man of his time, the fact that he'd defend that model. For a batsman, as successful as he was, I think there is some really interesting insight inevitably into how to bat. There's a really wonderful phrase where he talks about he doesn't believe there is such a thing as overconfidence in batting. He says batting is all confidence. And he says, look, any batsman has failed enough times to know that, you know, that there are difficult, that the game is complex, it's not always rewarding. And he said that actually it's all about confidence. He's got a wonderful phrase where he talks about a big innings being like a kind of tonic for one's cricket. You know, it really boosts everything, it boosts confidence. He also loves to talk about experimenting with strokes. And I think this is where, you know, Kevin Peterson came up a moment before. This is when, if I know it's a bit trite, but when you make comparisons between, say, Compton and Cricketers of the Future, he was a personality, a media personality, like many of today's cricketers. But also the way he saw experimenting with shots, I mean, that really makes him quite a modern cricketer.
Particularly when you compare him to someone like Hutton, and there are some descriptions in the book about how Hutton, when Hutton was captain and during the 50s, he very famously, basically his philosophy was, make sure that you can't lose by batting for a long, long time very slowly. And then if you can win, great, but you're not going to lose, so... it's fine. But there are some good descriptions of the way that of the way that Hutton and Compton clash, precisely because, as you say, Hutton was someone who was a bit of a revolutionary, wore his heart on his sleeve, played in an experimental way, whereas Hutton was someone who was very much of the old school, went out there, defended, and then went from there.
And so to the interview. Some of you may not have heard of Philip Brown, but you'll certainly have seen his work. He's one of the few specialist cricket photographers in the world, and his photos are regularly published by Cricketer magazine and a number of top newspapers. I began by asking what came first, cricket or photography?
I did like cricket when I was growing up in Australia, and I used to, you know, watch a lot on television, and I got taken to the odd game at the Sydney Cricket Ground by my father, which I still remember fondly. So I liked cricket, but then I got into photography, and I just wanted to go along to started off with I was also a huge rugby league fan, so I started going along to rugby league matches and basketball matches with a camera and taking photographs, and then slowly but surely people started paying me for these photos. I think I started to do more and more cricket, possibly because a lot of sports photographers don't like cricket because it takes all day and they have to get to the ground at, well, especially, say, a test match in England, you have to get to the ground probably before 8 o'clock to get parked right up, and you might be driving away at after 8 o'clock at night.
And so when you arrive at the ground in the morning, how do you decide for that particular day where you're going to position yourself, what you're going to focus on? Do you have a preconceived idea about the kind of shots that you want to get?
I'm thinking of a test match at Lord's. You get to the ground before kind of 9 o'clock, have a meeting. What they do these days, which is, from my perspective, far better, is they have a kind of allocation of positions. I have, you know, say they have 25 photography positions at Lord's. They'll have a kind of order, and they'll at 9:30 you'll have a meeting, and you know, anyone who's broken a rule or something will be frowned upon. And then they'll read out a list, and you know, you'll come out and you'll say, "Oh, I'd like to go and sit, you know, in front of the Edridge stand, or I'd like to go and sit next to the pavilion," and what have you. You'll go along. You'll try and get a good angle to possibly thinking about, you know, if wickets go, you might get a bowler celebrating, running past a batsman towards you, or if the other way, you might get a bowler appealing with the batsman in the background. So you kind of will have a specific angle that you want to be sitting at, which will mean that pictures of those kind of incidents will work the best.
Just changing tack slightly, it seems that the relationship between journalists and players is so regulated now, is by the huge press teams that surround any professional cricketer. What's your relationship with players like?
Well, from my perspective, it's, I think it's fairly positive. I think cricketers look at journalists and photographers kind of as separate entities, which is quite good.
Yeah.
And I think if you've been around long enough, to a point, cricketers kind of trust you and know you're not out there to stitch them up and, you know, get a picture of them with their finger up their nose or giving two fingers to the crowd or anything. So I'm thinking about the England team at the moment. I get on with all of them and chat with all of them. And basically, I'm probably seeing the core members of the England team, probably seeing them kind of 140, 150 days a year.
Yeah.
So it'd be odd if I didn't know them, if you know what I mean.
The situation with the BCCI at the moment, what do you think the fallout's going to be?
I'm fairly pessimistic about the future of cricket photography, and that does sound like a horrible thing to say, but if you've got boards around the world, like India at the moment, who basically said they did stop a lot of agencies coming in, as you know. Some agencies decided themselves that if other agencies weren't going in, that they were going to boycott it.
Yeah.
And they just controlled exactly who went in and what they could do with their photos, but said You know, we've got our own photographer here, and we'll supply, I think it was 10 photographs that newspapers in the UK can use. You know, that's not a problem. But, you know, really, and luckily the newspapers have said, you know, didn't use anything from that entire India-England series before Christmas. But, you know, seriously, are the BCCI going to put out photographs that represent, you know, the Indian players in a bad light? Say,
yeah,
you know, say a, you know, it's a, an obvious point, but if a fight starts on the field or something, they're not going to issue it. So it's a, it's a, was a kind of dark days for, you know, I had to use a term like press freedom or something, but it's just very sad the way it's gone.
I mean, there must have been a pretty despondent awe from your side of things then.
Normally, I love going to India. You know, it's just a fantastic place to take photographs. Mm. But when you've got those kind of restrictions on you, that I had, I was only allowed to send my photographs to the Cricketer magazine.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'd known that before I'd booked up and kind of paid for my trip, you know, it was a no-brainer. I wouldn't have even gone there.
Mm.
It could well be the first of kind of many, many tours that end up being similar. Mm. Really, I've been happy for over 20 years photographing cricket. That's what I want to do. I don't want to get involved with, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. It's dull, the politics of it. Just, you know, if possible, just let me be a photographer. Turn up, take some hopefully nice cricket images and go home.
So let's move away from the present and talk about happier times. Tell me about a particularly memorable photo that you've taken.
One of the photos that I'm proudest of has got, I suppose it's got a bit of a story behind it. I was, again, as a freelancer, I took myself out to the 2007 World Cup, which finished in Barbados. But the hotel I was staying in, I just happened to... A lady said, oh, we do a kind of walking tour on the Sunday morning. If you're interested in coming along with that, we'll see the monkeys down the road and go for a walk. So I got minimum amount of camera gear and got shown monkeys. And I must say, the photos I took of the monkeys that day were some of the worst monkey photos I've ever seen. I saw them again recently and thought, what waste of time that was. It was just, they're shocking, awful. But we walked on a little bit more, and there was a father and son, probably about a six-year-old boy, playing cricket on this absolutely idyllic beach with a few other people around, but not too many. A couple of stumps in the ground, and I thought, oh, that might be a good picture. I'm always on the lookout for kind of extra photos, cricket-related. And so I set it up and I, you know, played around with a few things and then asked the father, obviously, beforehand if it was all right if I took a few pictures of them playing. And out there, it's not a problem.
Mm.
Other place in the world might be more of a problem. It wasn't there. And literally digging a hole in the sand, holding a camera at kind of sand level, we'll call it, and taking pictures of this boy who was in the shadow of a palm tree with the sea and the sky and boats going past. So, and one of those pictures, to my mind, is one of the nicest pictures I've taken. And I think I like it even more because it was a day when I didn't think I was going to take a really nice cricket photo. I thought I was going to take a nice picture of a monkey. Didn't happen.
And finally, to the debate. And this week, there's been a lot of interest over the possibility of England women's cricketer Sarah Taylor possibly turning out for Sussex Second 11. We're asking whether Sarah Taylor playing professional men's cricket would be good for the women's game. I think it'd be fantastic for the women's game. First and foremost, no, this is not the long-term future of women's cricket. This isn't what we should necessarily be aiming for, getting lots of women into the county ground. But what this is an excellent publicity stunt. This week, we have women's cricket being talked about. We have it on the agenda. We have Sarah Taylor on the back of sports pages. It's good that the game's being talked about. It's good that she's being talked about it. There's also quite a powerful symbolic meaning to this. In so many sports, the women's game, I mean, I see this particularly powerfully in football. The women's game is always seen as inferior, as vastly inferior to the men's game. if you have a situation where, okay, we're not necessarily going to have a woman playing, you know, test cricket for England or something like that in the men's game, but a situation where you can see women and men competing side by side, it gives the women's game a really interesting level of legitimacy. You're saying, actually, no, there isn't this vast chasm in quality between the two games. There's actually a real, there's a real similarity, a parity.
So the games, the women's games that are seen to be most successful, probably tennis is the one that is seen to be strongest. Do any women's tennis players play in the men's game? No, it's seen as a different ball game, but that's probably the wrong metaphor. It's seen as being, I think you do actually make it look, hang on, you do make it look inferior by saying the very, very best women, so as you said, Sarah Taylor, regarded as probably the best player in the women's game at the moment, the very best women get to play in the men's game, the rest don't. The implication there is very, very strongly there are only a certain number of women who are good enough. Only one woman who's good enough to play in the men's game. The rest of them aren't good enough to play in the men's game. You're putting them on a scale by saying you have women's game, the best woman gets to play in the men's game, everyone who's below that gets to play in the women's game. Therefore, what you need to do, as they do in tennis, is to say they are completely different games. You watch them for different reasons.
I think the point is, there's an awareness that, yes, there is a quality gulf between women's and men's sport. For example, you know, a woman will never run as fast as a man, you know, whatever you want to call it, it's biology. The idea, though, in this case, is that in so many sports, it's just incomprehensible. You know, football being an example, it's incomprehensible that a woman would turn out, it's just not something that's seen as in any way possible. By making it even possible, you are suggesting that the ability in the two games is comparable. I don't really want to get into a debate about tennis, but I think it's a fair thing to bring up. I think what tennis is very fortunate with is that women's tennis offers something very qualitatively different to men's tennis. You get longer rallies, you get that sort of intricacy to it that often men's tennis, when it's more powerful, doesn't have it. I think that's actually a luxury that a lot of other sports don't necessarily get as such, because the women's version doesn't necessarily offer something qualitatively different.
So why is this... Is it good for Sarah Taylor or is it good for women's cricket? Because actually, there was a press release yesterday in which Sussex massively backtracked on the whole thing. They basically said, well, you haven't read the press release, did they? They basically said, and which is why I'm arguing what I'm arguing now, actually, partly, is they basically came out and said, look, we're not guaranteeing anything. There is a possibility that she will train with us, and we are looking for, because our two keepers are both in full-time education, so they won't be available at the beginning of the summer. The danger is that if we go by your argument that if she gets to play men's cricket, then everyone will suddenly think, oh, all women must be fantastic, which is just a flawed argument anyway, that if this doesn't work, it's massive pressure on her. If it doesn't work, it goes so drastically in the other direction, actually, that the, you know, she will be seen to have failed massively, and it will be seen to have been proved comprehensively that women can't play in the men's game. And actually, if you're looking for her to improve, surely it would be better for her to do what a lot of other women do. Two things. First, you do what a lot of other women do and play regularly for a team rather than occasionally stand in as a keeper for a county second 11. And secondly, I think there's a very valid point that actually quite a lot of the England women's team are quite annoyed that she is not. She hasn't actually reached the pinnacle. She has played 4 test matches and she averages 17 with the bat.
She's not been put in the team for a batting. She's been put in the team because she's meant to be a very good wicketkeeper.
Yeah, absolutely. But she has not. In the men's game, you need to be a good bat. You can't. No keeper survives in the men's game on being a good keeper.
I think the point, though, is that in a way, this is, well, two ideas. As a development opportunity, I agree. Week in, week out, it would be great saying play regularly for a men's club side. That would maybe be a better long-term development opportunity. But you can't deny that actually for a period of time, you improve by playing with people who are better than you. For a period of time, getting women involved in that sort of level of cricket, I think would be good for player development.
So she needs to play with people who are better and all women are worse than her, so she has to go off and play with men. I think the message here is so strongly that she is too good for the women's game, that the women's game is... This is exactly the public message of this whole thing. The woman's game is not good enough for a woman who's really good. She has to go and play for the men's game.
I don't think that's the message at all. I mean, there's
why
no...
Not? Isn't that the reality? Why is she going to play for the men's game, then?
The idea is not that she is too good for the women's game, but that she is good enough to play in the men's game. There's no suggestion at all
there are men who are good enough to play in the women's game. I mean, you don't... No, you don't... It's ludicrous to suggest that you're not saying that she is playing in the men's game because the quality is better.
No, she is playing in the men's game because she is good enough to compete at that
because
higher level.
Because the quality is better in the men's game.
No one's denying the quality is better.
So she's,
one's denying the quality is better. The point is not that that's not a debate. There's no debate to be had that the quality of men's cricket is better than the quality of women's cricket. That's an accepted fact. What is interesting is the fact that whereas in some sports that gulf is unbridgeable, there is a genuine possibility here that a female cricketer could compete alongside male cricketers. And that's something that is not seen as a possibility in an awful lot of other sports.
But I just don't see what it would achieve being able to say a women's cricketer once was able to play in the men's game. Right, so that means that all the women who come after her who can't play in the men's game are just not up to scratch because that's a new benchmark.
It suggests that women's cricket and men's cricket are not, even though men's cricket is superior in ability to women's cricket, are not vastly different. You're not watching totally different products. And I think it's worth saying that I think this may have actually succeeded already without her even coming anywhere near the second 11. Because what it's done is it's had a sport that has not had the attention, which frankly, for the success that England's women have had, has not had the attention necessarily.
She's just had the attention, the sport hasn't.
Well, no, it's impossible for her.
I think that's very true. I don't think anyone has learned anything more about the England women's team other than that they are unsatisfying to someone to play with.
Someone has seen the newspaper this week, and they may well now take an interest in how Sarah Taylor performs. They may therefore, as a conduit from that, take an interest in how the England
is performing. I mean, that's like saying you put dancing games at 2020 matches and you get people to watch the dancing games, dancing girls. And then you go from... I just think that the message is very clear.
Taken a greater interest in dancing girls since 2020?
And in 2020. But the message, it seems to me, is just very clear indeed. I agree that from her own point of view, if she wants to go, as a player development thing, going and playing in a tougher environment, absolutely, is a good thing for her. But the message is very much, you have a women's game, and if you're at the top of the women's game, you then, if you want to test yourself, you go out and you play in the men's game. And the message of that, very clearly, is that the cream of women's players should be playing, aren't more associated with the men's game than they are with the women's game, which is degrading to the women's game. Thanks for joining us here on Reverse Web Radio as we've reflected on everything from the future of cricket photography to the relationship of cricket and snow. Do join us again in a couple of weeks.